Welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. We're here to teach some rhetoric. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor. I don't know, abandoned professor. I was a professor for a little while. Stand-up comedian, comedy writer from Late Night in Hollywood. And this is our special series. This is the rhetorician interviews. The rhetoric files instead of the Rockford files for those who are 900 years old. And each one of these is a deep dive into a rhetorical themed topic. And one of our rhetoricians in residence, Dr. David Payne, emeritus from South Florida, interested in the rhetoric of transformation, specialist in Kenneth Burke, knows a lot about failure. Which is an odd statement, but is
not all of that intentional. Yes.
So, how you doing, David?
I'm good. Thank you.
Surviving the Florida nature pollen attacks.
Wow. It's been a heavy year. Absolutely. We had a big rainstorm yesterday, so that knocked a lot of it out of the air. So I can at least breathe today.
My favorite part of Florida was always walking out and watching the lizards just scatter. You know, and thinking, gosh, if those things were full size, that would be a very different experience.
Yeah, and if you watch them closely, you get some real Jurassic Park kind. You know, if you just scale it down, like different kinds of lizards preying on each other and stuff, it's pretty amazing.
My friend Tom Ryan lived in Florida. He's a stand-up and lived there for quite a while. Tells a story about one day he killed a roach with a fly swatter in his house and opened up the back door to fling it out and threw it right to a gecko. Like, and this lizard was like, what's going on?
Sometimes the break goes your way, right?
Yeah, for sure. So we've talked about a few different things. This is our fifth episode with Dave Payne. And today we're going to talk about the topic of education. And I think this came out because, we talked about how rhetoric was kind of squished out of academics and came back in weaker formats like advertising, poli-sci, sociology, psychology. And we got a little bit into, you know, the Greek tradition of this being in the trivium for a long time. And then just they disappeared it. They didn't want the people to know about rhetoric.
Right. Well, I think it got, you know, in an age of science and knowledge, it got subordinated. As you know, and of course, the extent to which the educational system was gripped by the neoclassicist, you know, Plato's condemnation that this is just a knack, like cookery, and not really a source of knowledge, as translated into the modern scientific mindset, caused it to be, So part of what has gripped, you know, academe for the last 150 years is this kind of disciplinary knowledges. And that has always left, performance and rhetoric and skills themselves as subordinate.
So do you see that as like the core of rhetoric? I mean, it does have this strong skill component, and that's kind of the way I approach it when I take it out into the world about here's useful ways of influencing, you know, those that you need to influence. But it's also got this deep epistemology and philosophy to it that other people, I think people don't know that comes along with the package.
Well, I think it does, but it's not the same epistemology. That is, it's not the same idea of knowledge as the tree of the disciplines with philosophy and the branches. And so I think that entire disciplinary urge of compartmentalizing knowledges into specialized sciences runs absolutely counter to rhetorical knowledge, which is really of necessary. We call it interdisciplinary now, but it's really non-disciplinary.
Right.
And you talked about the Middle Ages trivium, where basically the half of the day would be spent in grammar and rhetoric and logic. But grammar and logic and rhetoric themselves have been disciplinized. At that time, you know, grammar wasn't learning the rules of language. It wasn't, logic wasn't, you know, symbolic logic. And, right. So they were practiced, right? Logic was dialectics, and you learned that by doing it, by doing argumentation. So all of that was pre-disciplinary, really. And so the second half of the day would be spent in subject matters, mostly math and science. And there's a certain appeal to that. And at any rate, the point being is that those were learned in doing and skill.
Do you think rhetoric's too messy
and
for institutions?
You should know a lot about, you know, ideally the rhetorician would know a lot about a lot of different things.
Right. So do you think rhetoric is too messy for institutionality? Is that the problem?
I think in theory, yes. That is, institutions like to be tidier than that, and they like to use those sorts of tidy demarcations as ways of drawing boundaries and creating power. And rhetoric, once again, militates against that. So I think that might be perceived as too messy. At the same time, I think that's the virtue, is messing up precisely those institutional urges would be one of its values. That this all be subjected to the realm of practice. What makes it happen? So where does knowledge become applied? And so, you know, for many years, about the time of your education, there was this big applied communication movement. Well, that was always kind of ironic because there really isn't any such thing as unapplied communication.
Right. Yeah, it all comes out of practice, right?
But once again, that verbiage was based upon the idea that there is pure research, pure inquiry that is divorced from and modeled on disciplinary knowledges that is removed from the realm of practice. And once again, in the scientific branches, that may be possible. I think you know, the idea of rhetoric has once again floundered every time it tried to formulate itself in that way, as somehow a way of knowing that is removed from what people do. And once again, has to constantly revise itself because what people do is always changing.
Well, I know in my use of this out in the real world, in businesses and things like that, when they find out that I'm a rhetorician, which they usually say rhetorician, I'm instantly suspect, because it's this idea that I can go in, and of course you can in rhetoric, and sort of auger their language, you know, and find the flaws. You know, the first thing they always think is I'm, you know, going to be a grammarian and call them out on their misstatements.
Right.
And they find out, no, it's me actually looking at the blueprints and the blueprinting of your consciousness, you know, through linguistic structures. And I can go in there and start to, you know, deconstruct that and pull threads. It makes them nervous.
How your language is making you perceive and behave accordingly, and that runs against what has been called at least a naive verbal realism, the belief that we want to believe that our words accurately reflect both what's in our head and what's in the world, right? If we say you're this or that, we want that to be true. And so we proceed accordingly. So driving that wedge is a kind of a sophistication that does breed mistrust.
Oh, people hate it. They hate this idea that there's no way to get behind.
However,
language.
You know, it's the basis of all of the therapy that communication does. Here, wait a minute. So pause for a moment and ask, is this language doing what you want it to do? What is the language doing to the relationship, et cetera, right?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, you go back, I took an English grad course when I was at UT from, I can't remember his name, but a little monk who had been a Catholic monk for 40 years and was a Greek scholar and decided to quit the order and come out into the world. And he got me reading the Nietzsche stuff about truth and falsity, you know, basically that
Jim
language.
Canavy?
What's that?
Did you take a class from Jim Canavy?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah. Very famous rhetoric scholar in English, right?
Yeah, he was awesome. He did tell me once. When I wrote a bibliography and I thought I was supposed to do it in the original languages or whatever. And he's like, given your Italian, I would have just done this in English. And I'm like, yeah, there's no Italian here. It was me faking it. But he started, you know, into this Nietzsche in the truth and falsity in the ultra-moralistic sense, you know, that essay where basically
not really, but
Nietzsche argues that all language is metaphor and all metaphors lies. So ergo, all language is lies. So quit relying on it, you know, because it's going to take you down weird paths. And my point was, well, that in itself, you know, is a weird path and a lie, because it's also a lie that you can't rely on language, because language is telling you not to rely on language. And so you get into these circular things, but people get very nervous when you give language that kind of primacy. They want their emotions, they want their perception, they want their real life as their core.
Right, and I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the kind of cynicism that is currently polluting a lot of the political discourse as kind of a first level of critical thinking, where you mistrust media, you mistrust everything. There was an article this last week that mistrust of media is now a platform belief of the Republican Party, right? This is no longer just a sidecar, that it is essential somehow as a doctrine. What's in that complete skepticism is kind of the first base of critical thinking, where, and I wonder how much in teaching rhetoric we fuel that, to be people to be suspicious of language. That it's always doing this, it's always lying, it's always right distorting. And if you don't go any farther to then ask, well, how do we then proceed with those tools to do the stuff that we need to do?
Well, and I think that's a great point, this idea of they're moving down the sort of critical thinking ladder of skepticism, which is where you kind of start. You know, I guess that's the second rung. The first rung is pure acceptance, and then you get into some sense of skepticism. But so many people, that's where they stay. Like, it seems like that's the only...
Right, it is a kind of a thwarted adolescent stage, I think, to not realize that everything good that got done through language, too. Knowing the difference is the real point about criticism, isn't it?
Right.
Right.
And I've made this point with my kids a lot when I try to get them, you know, when the pandemic first started and we had everything to do, I have an 8-foot whiteboard upstairs on the wall, and I forced them to sit through college lectures, because I'm like, well, you know, you're not going to college. Zeke's not going to college right away. So at least I'm going to give you the experience of being lectured to, and showing them sort of that kind of, here's some critical thought that most people get to, like, as an undergrad, like things like everything is subjective. And I'm like, right. Sure. Now that's better than everything is objective and that there's no leeway, but it's still an incorrect, immature thought. Not all subjectivities are equal. And so let's keep going down the ladder.
Or that doesn't mean, yeah, that's right. That doesn't mean that all points of view are equal, or that, they can all easily be dismissed in favor of, right, that they're arbitrary.
Yeah,
which is another kind of corollary bit of modern relativism.
So this digs into kind of the topic here, like our education, maybe it's filtering, you know, some of the lessons from more critical education have filtered out in through the media, like a distrust of the media and stuff like that. But it's not going far enough to be useful. It's just becoming, you know, that kind of frozen in time, and just it ends up getting in the way because the education isn't even anywhere near complete. I mean, is that the problem? Like 80% of the deeper education can't filter into the media. We can't get it out there. It's not compatible with the format.
That sounds good. I want to think that one through a little bit as far as, is that what's going on? I don't know. Maybe it's just as running up against so many other kinds of things, like so many other agendas, that is a convenient truth, right? To coin a phrase, that one can seize upon that sort of easy relativism as a way of defending any point of view that I want to prefer for whatever reason. So I think there are a lot of psycho and social reasons that go into people's holding on to the ideological beliefs that they have. Once again, that only to destabilize the knowledge industries, right? Journalism, history, science, literature, to create skepticism about those and sort of say, well, they're all deceptions, right? It's just another variant of the, oh, well, all politicians are liars. Right. So I don't have to worry about my guideline.
Well, it's half the statement, right? Like all of these are deceptive, but they also carry truth. They're both there all the time. And that's a more sophisticated read of it that people aren't getting to. They're stopping halfway into the statement.
I once formulated that in criticism that we kind of had it backwards. Let's see if I can call that back. That when we approach literature and media and text and those kinds of things, criticism tends to assume that, you know, this is fictional, this is created. But then how do you seize the truth in it? Right, that there is some truth being got at through drama, through literature, through art, whatever. Right, when we turn to politicians, it's the whole politicians are pretending to tell the truth, but we try to look for the lie in it. And then maybe we've gone too far down that road. We need to switch them around. That we know the politicians are lying. How are they struggling to tell the truth and the necessary lies that they tell to, you know, get past the mind guards of the public? And controversial. We know that the artist thinks he's telling the truth. How is this art distorting our perceptions of things? And to be fair, in critical studies, we've kind of gotten to that point. And maybe a little too assertive of a way that, gee, all literature, all art is somehow ideological and taking us down. No, that's also the way that we've done being a human being for a long time. And we don't want to dismiss it all either.
So
once again, in both cases, that kind of rabid skepticism begins to achieve a self-undermining point.
Well, and it's interesting the way the GOP has picked up a variation of that sort of blanket cynicism against, like, one of the foundations, I think, like humanism. I mean, it has a cynicism about humanism, about compassion, about caring, about taking care of people, that it sees those, you know, as naive, as tax raising, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's like it's imported the energy, you know, the psychic energy of that sort of critical theory, and it's reflecting them back on things where that critical theory came from. You know, it's this weird big Archimedes mirror of, you know, attack, 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 attack. And it's just reflecting that stuff now back on things where, really, I think Reagan started that, right? This whole idea of anti-government, of attacking the government as a failed institution itself and making that a primary platform. And it's just spread like mushrooms, you know, in a garden, where now they just attack everything that was traditionally set up as maybe a good humanistic practice.
Right. Now almost half the people in government don't believe in government. And you see the results. Right.
Well, it's like he captured that 70s energy, you know, that anti-war energy and that anti-energy, and just turned.
I don't know if he started it, but he certainly fueled it in our lifespan in ways. So I think that's a good impulse.
And they're also
to acknowledge him for it,
right?
Not a good impulse to have.
Well, you know, I did a little bit of tracking of this stuff back. You know, if you go back to Nixon and all the way back into, you know, his McCarthyism and, you know, his training there about, again, it's just that hyper aggressive, attack oriented politician. And they're just finding targets, 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 targets. But the rhetoric is the same of there's something rotten in Denmark over here, and I'm just going to tell you about it.
Right. Well, just on that sort of historical point, that since I saw you last, I've watched the Ken Burns 7 episodes of the Roosevelts. Pretty fascinating stuff historically, because my instincts are that a lot of what we're talking about socially and culturally and even in education are kind of an end of that kind of New Deal idealism that began with the Great Depression. It was secured itself largely because of the Great Depression. So I think there's something cyclical about this. If you look at, there was an article just in the last week or so about how this idea that government has no role in our lives is sort of libertarian ultimate, that it really should be doing nothing except providing for the military in a real fundamentalist way. That kind of Rand Paul extremism that was around, you know, at the birth of the libertarian the contemporary libertarian urge. At any rate, that would be more the case, I think, in 1928 than in 1930. Right. So the we had then a shifting of opinions of what government should be doing for you, and Roosevelt was really politically, in many ways, the architect of all of that. And of course, our own recent experience, the pandemic, plus what seems to be a kind of a mass holdover from the recession's last depression of 2008 and 9, again, is maybe revising people's opinions of what government can do. So, you know, there's at least, well, at least a historical parallel, as well as the possibility that some of that will be revised.
So let's rip this all the way back to education, because you just learned something from, you know, public media, the Roosevelt series with Ken Burns. Sure. Was a public, you know, semi-intellectual. I think he does interesting deep dives into things way deeper, I think, in some ways than what you can do, because he's got production capacity that academics don't have. He may not go into all the tributaries of, you know, all the bibliographies and all the theories that inform that.
He does his research pretty thoroughly. Yeah. I'm pretty impressed.
Well, and I've always had this feeling of, you know, seeing what big Hollywood can do, and even big documentary like what he does, versus what one individual teaching in a classroom can do. You know, why do those things don't marry up more often to create these sort of super education products? I don't know, but like we get like Neil deGrasse Tyson level kind of stuff versus, you know, sort of super deep. You know, you got a little bit like with Stephen Hawking's, you know, in the science fields, because that's sexy enough, I guess, to sell to enough nerds. But how come we don't get enough of that super product of those two worlds? Because it can create cool stuff.
Well, you know, Ken Burns and Neil deGrasse Tyson and Oliver Stone and others that we might style as public intellectuals didn't get there by accident. I mean, public education was working pretty well. So they're not at opposite poles of anything, but I think one could look at the last 20 years and note the absence of public intellectuals, just as having, you know,
even political intellectuals, right? Like the George Wills and those guys had disappeared.
You know, and my taste, you know, seeing George Will now commentary on what's going on is really refreshing. That's, I guess, the other recent experience is it's opened us up to a lot more points of view than perhaps we were before.
Right. Yeah.
And in fact, he was one of the big commenters on Teddy Roosevelt in the series. I didn't realize he was an expert.
Interesting. So if you projected yourself, like you had a 40-year career at least, right, in academics.
Sure.
And you never wandered over into media. Like, this is probably the farthest you've ever wandered into media in this podcast.
Oh, into making media?
Any type of taking your stuff and moving it out of text.
I wandered into using it a lot. I mean, and bringing it into the classroom. I think I was, at least influential to the small groups around me and always using media text in the classroom very early on. Mm-hmm. And bringing that to people, so doing some kind of media literacy by watching stuff together with my students.
Right.
So I certainly didn't want any artificial barrier to that. And that has done nothing but grown exponentially in the last, you know, 30 years, absolutely. But in terms of doing making those things myself, I just never figured I had the talent or the industry to do that.
Well, it's mostly team, I find, really. You know, it's right. Every one of those jobs, like when you're on a TV show, there's 125 people working on that show, each one doing separate jobs.
And yeah, it's not accidental that a lot of the video learning that's available in the subject matters that we teach of mass communication and advertising and persuasion were by people in mass comm departments. Because they had those teams around them that were doing production.
Right.
Back to the importance of practice. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the power of rhetoric, you know, as language in action, you know, as taking whatever the concepts are, whatever the scripts are, the verbiage, and saying, well, I want to do something in the world with this and make something happen in the world with this. You would think rhetoric would be, you know, not just open, but like leading the way in the use of media and how to adapt that medium so you can do things like education with it. You know, I sometimes look at it like what things are right now, the level where they are right now, as when they first started TV and they just filmed plays. You know, they set up three cameras and just ran a play in front of them, and there you go. That was the aesthetics of the medium. But sure, like the aesthetics of education in modern media doesn't really seem like they've been fully fleshed out yet. I know my son taught himself video editing and special effects and everything else by using multiple YouTube locations, multiple teachers, and just cycling through them according to his desire or his evaluation of them and point of need education. And watching him learn like that, I'm so jealous. I'm like, oh my God, that's such a better way of learning. You know, sure, every question answered by somebody quickly.
Well, and those things are, I mean, there's a lot of great educational TV. You could get a pretty good college education just by having a good television diet, right? I mean, and people in education using production, that's going on and has been going on increasingly. So your question of why didn't rhetoric somehow have more to do with that? And I think this gets back, the answer gets back to this idea of a discipline called rhetoric. There was a rhetoric being invented by the people doing that as they, right? There just wasn't this sort of self-critical vehicle of what's my rhetoric doing? Or is this, you know, what are the language choices we're making here? The editing choices or inventing a new grammar of video? I recall when I first got to South Florida teaching a class and I found the writing skills pretty much suffering. And I turned my students loose with making a video as their final project. And they were great. And I thought, these people have internalized the grammar of video production just by being consumers in ways that they have not any form of academic or critical writing.
Right.
Because they never read any of it. That was not right. So at any rate, I think we have internalized those grammars. And that, yes, there's a trivium operating there. There is a rhetoric, there is a grammar, and there is a logic to that are evolving very quickly with the media. So quickly, nobody has time to step outside of that and systematize it into some sort of disciplinary knowledge. But that's why the gap in education of these things has always been, there's been such a cultural delay because once again, this idea that to be academics and to publish and to get certified knowledge, we have to do disciplinary knowledge. We have to formulate stuff as though it's not going to change, and we have to teach it in a certain way. So there's necessarily a conservatism to that. So if you look at, you know, the evolution of things like public relations or advertising as it is taught versus how it is practiced, the gaps are huge, right? You know, if I would think if rhetoric could do anything, it would be to liberate us from that, to recognize that there is an inventional component to all of this stuff, that those things are moving targets constantly. And of course, for me, to step back is something like the kind of McLuhan and Ong idea of media evolution and media ecology. That we have to, you know, that all takes place in a certain larger environment and historical as these technologies change. So anyway.
Well, and I'm watching older professors, since those are most of my friends, wander toward the use of media like TikTok and short video and even online courses and taking people through that experience. And I watched them do production for themselves on short videos. And I'm like, get somebody to set lights for you. Because you just, you know, face bathed in light has no distinction to it. And you want them to be able to, you know, do the basics of, like you said, the grammar of this, the new technology, the new mediums, because they've got better content, I think, than the people who understand the aesthetics of it and the grammar and the production of it, but they don't have that kind of hardcore and even really old school rhetoric content and things like that.
Yeah, there's an inherent fallacy in terms of trying to adapt oneself to each new medium. I mean, professors doing TikTok alongside of, I don't know, the floss dance or whatever it is they're doing, or big, you know, all the things that go on there. There's just no reason to try to compete on that turf. I guess I was always kind of retro about it in terms of my own. I thought the classroom should be a space for orality, that there is still room for orality in our culture. Now, what's happened in the last 2 years with the public, you know, the physical space of education being completely destroyed by pandemic is, and I, you know, the question is, how do we return? And I'd have to think that maybe some medium here of not returning all the way to the rules and procedures of those classrooms might be a good thing. In other words, for, you know, elementary education, you know, right now the parents are going, oh my God, I've got to go through, you know, I've got to learn all this stuff online and you know, teach my child. Well, the good part of that is having parents actually part of the educational process, right? Sure. Maybe keeping some of that wouldn't be such a bad idea, right? So maybe some, you know, if they return to some sort of half and half, this could be the possibility of breaking, you know, having the child there during the work day is itself not necessarily a product of education or for education. It's for the other structures of society.
Yeah.
And having it limited to the bounds of the classroom and the teacher relationship is certainly not particularly healthy for education. Yeah. Being able to incorporate other media and to integrate media consumption with, right, media learning with what happens in the classroom is also healthy for education.
Well, I know, like, and you mentioned orality. I think the things that I've seen this population, the younger population now, just finds to be abhorrent, like they can't tolerate it, is like monologue, extended monologue. Mm. They can't do it. Even the Zoom structure like this, I think, is much better over listening to a dialogue. At least you're switching voices, you're switching characters, perspectives.
And if you want to switch screens, right.
Yeah, and there's things that you can do with it, and then you can do production flavor if you really want. I mean, it's pretty easy to Instagram or, you know, sort of throw production quirk into this stuff. But even the fact that it's not just extended monologue, which is the core of education, right?
Well, seemingly, you know, the monologic has been under assault at all levels of education for many years. I'm mostly familiar with what goes on in the college classroom, but I think one of the problems is, and we can come back to this maybe at some point, is that universities have been directing so much of what goes on, and that that's resistant to change rather than innovative. But
right.
But certainly micro teaching short sections and then doing an activity, the way that I've trained teachers for the last 30 years has, you know, related to that, to, you know, note, and of course, having observed many student teacher lectures, that's not what you should go to. Right? That's not the strength of most people. So breaking up the classroom with media excerpts, with activities, so I think that you're right, there's a resistance that's happening in communication classrooms, which are innovative in their audience orientation. If you go out into the other hinterlands of the disciplines, you won't find that as much. Yeah, I remember when I once again first came to South Florida, I was up at school at night and I walked by a classroom and there was a teacher wandering up and down rows of desks talking, and they had their books open. You know, what must be going on here? This is a thing I haven't seen for many years, right?
Well, I've taught multiple sections of crowd work courses or entertainment techniques for teachers.
Right.
Because stand-ups they're artists of crowd psychology. They will not let your mind wander anywhere else for more than 4 seconds. Like, they force you to listen. And that kind of the riveting techniques of how to do that, they're very you know, tactical, and they're very mechanistic, and you can study them and you can teach them. Like, for example, I mean, just conflict, you know, there's very little amplified conflict in a college classroom. There's some subtle conflicts and background conflict, but you're never worried about, you know, two people usually going at it. And if you look at media, media is all intense activated conflict, and that's what they're trained to. So I would play around with that when I would teach. Like, every once in a while, if I felt any boredom in the room, I would just look at somebody and say, I'm going to, you, and everybody like, what's happening? I'm like, see, a little bit of conflict and you're all back with me. But that's that kind of, again, like you said, that lived rhetoric of learning how to work with modern audiences in the moment to keep them where you need them to be so that they can do things like process information and remember information. And again, when I talk about rhetoric leading that, it's the fact I could do that stuff consciously and I could abstract out the techniques and teach them to other people because I had a rhetoric background and I knew to look for that stuff.
Right. Well, that's the, I was attributed to Kant that a lecture is a way of getting the notes of the professor to the notes of the students without passing through the minds of either.
Yeah, that's about right.
What's again, not to continue to sell my hobby horse here, but it is the dominance of literacy that knowledge is contained in books, and we have to get those books in people's heads, and that must be structured by writing structures.
Right.
And this gets back to this idea that sciences are organized into disciplines and best learned as disciplines, that it's about knowledge and people, you know, people gaining knowledge. It was Eric Hoffer that said, we don't need to produce students who are learned as much as learning. Or, you know, in other words, you need to be able to teach people to learn, not to be learned. And in the contemporary world, there's it seems to me that the media revolution is, whether we wanted it to or not, students do not see being a knower as part of their self-image, because the telephone or the your smartphone is an incredible storage and retrieval, you know, object of knowledge. That's an externalized process.
Right.
Right. You're a dinosaur if you want to hold all the trivia in your own head and be able to recall it at any moment, right? But that was the mode of education I was raised into, right?
Right.
Somehow in fifth grade, I had to learn all there was to know about this period of history and to be able to recall it. Once again, to make people repositories of knowledge and being learned in subject matters, and to encourage people as soon as possible to silo that knowledge into different disciplines. Well, that's just coming unraveled as part of secondary orality in the contemporary media, right? And the technological revolution has kind of enabled that. But no, I don't need to be a knower of that. I can gain those knowledges at literally the push of a button. So
does it become like, again, when you talk about the skills and the in practice, the praxis of rhetoric, part of it is the ability to audit, you know, and extract from any text, so that you can see the themes, you can see the patterns, you can see the techniques, and then therefore, you know, the next step of that is to be able to take those out and use them and improvise with them and innovate with them and all that.
Right.
But it doesn't really, I mean, it helps, you know, to be able to retain and recall the theories and the extractions other people have already created before you, so that you know to look at something from a feminist perspective or a, you know, Burkean perspective. It improves your auditing and extracting. And then that third stage of improvising and using, like, I moved over fairly quickly after I finished my PhD to this idea of consumer versus producer. When I started working and getting paid for producing entertainment, live entertainment, and then television entertainment, I got the real sense of what it felt like to produce with all this knowledge. And that just took over for me, like the innovation and the improvising and the creation. That producing energy was so much better than the auditing energy, you know? And so I
and those shouldn't really be divorced, you know, how that, you know, it's interesting to me to watch actors that you consider to be middle of the road actors, but eventually start doing directing and production themselves, right? One wonders how one makes that transition about, you do this so many times, like Clint Eastwood or whatever, right?
Right.
You wouldn't have thought him as the most intelligent actor in the world, but he's made a ton of successful movies as a director, right? At what point does that just become embodied, that you're on the receiving end of this and you see the ways it's done? So the auditing process has to be part of that learning, obviously. But it is in the composition. It's kind of like if somebody tells you how to get there, they're writing in your car and they give you directions and turn here and turn here and to here. You can't find the place in the next time because you didn't make all those choices yourself. You didn't internalize the map of it somehow.
Right.
But when you find the way yourself, you actually know, you know, what the choices are about. And I would see that turn to being a producer. And once again, that gets back to practice, right? How different is logic if you are a producer, if you're making arguments, than if you're trying to learn, you know, the syllogistic square of reasoning or whatever.
Well, I think I'm running into this, like with interviewing academics and intellectuals and people I've known for a long time, that as soon as you get pulled into the podcast format and this idea that you're going to do a few of these, or maybe it's going to be an ongoing thing, you start to have ideas about it, about how to produce it, how to make it better. And you've said this to me, I'm going to do another one with John Llewellyn here, and suggesting like, let's focus on a topic so I can think about it a little bit and develop my content and have some scriptedness to it. Those are all producer thoughts.
Right.
And I think what you were always good at, the reason I like taking your courses, wasn't always like, I think you had a good understanding of the primary text, but it was more like you're talking about, the ability to audit and extract information from things that you brought in, that that's where your strength is, that you are really good at taking these things and applying them in novel ways to sort of new product.
Well, that, and I hope part of that was responding to learning from my students' reactions as well. What did they find to say? Certainly, maybe I kept that a secret, but being stimulated by my students was to me both the joy and the art of it. I would hope if I found myself, I guess it's back to your model of the stand-up. If I found myself silencing my students, I know that I was doing it wrong.
Well, I'm curious, like when you look at the podcast format, you've done 5 of these now. What are your thoughts about it as an educational tool?
Oh, I haven't thought about it as an educational tool, especially. I mean, I think this is we're just recording a conversation about things, keeping it spontaneous and letting it go where it needs to go has been kind of what we've done, right? Without a lot of scripting, so. I think it's like many things. For the right person who is capable of learning, these could be very useful. For somebody who, you know, to force it into an institutionalized format where you prescribe it for the masses, would probably have some problems, right? Coming up with the production of textbooks always is to me an incredible process. But beyond sort of making sure you have the same topics as everybody else's textbook, that they're organized in this outline kind of format for once again, ease of retrieval and codification into test questions, coming up with all the supplementary materials kept me completely out of the industry, right? The study guides, the formulating it into...
How did they do that? Like the most dynamic thinking in the world, and they just killed it in the translation down into, you know, that's that Burkean, the bureaucratization. You know,
it is a product, a low level product of the disciplinary thinking. How do, the textbook must somehow codify what is known and corral it into these learnable, memorable, memorizable kinds of ways that could be evaluated through pen and paper tests. So it is itself kind of the worst end of what we're talking about, so foreign to the learning event itself. And I never quit struggling with that particular problem or with textbooks themselves. especially the textbook on public speaking. We're talking about performance or whatever.
It's funny. My daughter goes to the University of North Texas, and she didn't know what to major in, so she ended up in communication. And she was taking Intro to Rhetoric, and I asked her what the textbook was, and it was Bill Keith's introduction.
I didn't know Bill had one. Yeah,
to rhetoric. And I'm like, well, what do you think of it? And she's like, I hate it. It's terrible. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to call him right now and tell him my daughter hates textbook.
On the other hand, on the market is also Dinah Shore's textbook for public speaking. And it's true. Anybody can have one. So.
Well, and it is that sort of ugly bastardization of, and politics does this. And again, going back to the idea of cynical and the use of skepticism to create suspicion in a political audience that then becomes a road to fascism. That's an amazing bastardization of, you know, the very core of this whole critical theory and the whole critical schools of existentialism and everything else. It's like this, you know, plasticization of it to turn it into a rhetorical program. It's amazing.
That could be. I think what we're talking about is in part, I don't know that there's been a significant revolution in education in the last 75 years.
I haven't noticed one.
I think of Dave Hickey saying regulation of art by the university has left us without any revolution in art. The longest period of time in history without any significant change. And so that teaching what is of value and what there is to do. So, you know, even though it has incorporated and institutionalized, or think about, you know, modern, they're still teaching modern dance, which was this thing that happened in the 50s. Right. And we're no, you know, I don't know that they do postmodern dance. Maybe somebody does. I'm not sure I would want to see any or would recognize it if I did.
Just people standing there.
And even though there are movements in the last 100 years in education and whatever, teaching, you know, the new math and yada, yada, yada. I don't think there has really been a paradigm change. Anything like, you know, what Dewey and others did in that same kind of generative period of the early 20th century. And why is that? Why is that? And I think the kinds of things that we're talking about, importing the idea that everything must be subject to methodology, which is a conceit of science that seeped out into social sciences and humanities and artistic production. We must be able to replicate these things with methodological meta, right? The word is literally a method is really a meta word,
right?
So reflection about or codification of the ways that we do things is sort of really what the word means, I guess. So anyway, it seems to me that textbook production, classroom management, all of these things sort of falls into that regulation. That means there won't be significant change. We militated against that. So when something radical does happen, right, we're all shocked and outraged and frightened.
So how did you stay in it so long, man? I tried to put up with the institutionality of education.
Well, I want to joke and say there was a book being passed around when I was in graduate school by Professor X. That's what it was called. This Beats Working for a Living, which was actually just a good title. It was actually a very sober book about a guy's struggles with teaching and being a professor. It really wasn't at all radical.
Well, and I totally, you know, I get it, but there was a point when I was like, the best thing about this job is the fact that I don't have to do this job that much. And I'm like, that's got to be wrong. I don't want to continue this. Like, I really enjoy managing information and turning it into communication and even turning it into enlivening communication so that it will, you know, grab brains instead of them having to force themselves to stay in it. But the institutionality and just all the different things that attack that process, I admire, like you and Newman and, you know, people that have stayed in it for as long as you have. I just feel like you've, it's like the gauntlet.
Well, I don't want to dismiss it. And I almost wanted, when we started, to issue sort of a caveat that criticizing education is a very iffy business, because the real critics of education right now are dangerous people. And there's so much good that happens. There's so many good people in education doing good things, true. Because there are little spaces of freedom there and lack of supervision.
Right.
So it's not a perfect system of regulation. I mean, in the rough bounds, there certainly is regulation. And I don't know anybody who didn't struggle some with institutional pressures. And if they weren't struggling with them, should be suspect. But it's dangerous to tinker with something that is working. I think about education the way I think about, our medical systems right now. I've never had a doctor that I didn't think was a pretty smart, competent person with good knowledge trying to do good things for me, right? Some of their manners or, whatever weren't optimum human relations work, but I don't think any of them really did anything but help me. But they were all struggling with the systematic limitations of our medical system, which is completely overwhelmed. In the interest of full disclosure, my brother is a medical doctor, but I think teachers are the same way. I think by and large, all of those instincts and creativity, not universally, but in general, the people doing good things, and to be without it would be horrible.
Right.
I do think in many ways, a lot of our contemporary struggles with the politics that we've been talking about are more than an urban-rural divide or an education divide. So that means some good things had to have gotten done there that you wouldn't want to be without. So one tinkers with it, and that's maybe part of the reason for an inherent conservatism that flows through the institutions. So with all of that caveat, said, I think it is time to rethink and take opportunities, and one can be subversive and one can exercise freedom. A number of years ago, they were always, it became fashionable to ask us to put together our teaching philosophy. And Richard Rorty had a phrase in one of his essays that really captured my imagination. He says, there's really not much else you can do but enact freedom in the presence of your students. That became my teaching philosophy.
No, that's awesome. What a great line.
Don't expect much more from it, but be sure and do that, right? And so I could at least demonstrate intellectual freedom. And I figured locking children up in a room with somebody for 16 weeks that has that kind of education and responding to the world in those ways can't be a bad thing.
So. Yeah. Well, and I remember I went back to the South and taught, at the University of Louisville. And then I taught at Peace College in North Carolina. And those students, I recognize that progression, that a lot of them were coming through first generation, no real innovation or AKA revolution in their family lines for a long time. And again, it is part of that. Like you do sort of model a different person for them. And I remember a girl at Peace College, it was an all female Presbyterian college in the South, bad fit for me. But towards the end of the semester, we were
good
talking.
Good experience for you.
What's that?
Good experience for you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It was an interesting experience. I learned a lot there. But
okay.
She said one of the last classes, I was talking about what do you do with this, because I was teaching the media. I started a little media program there. And she's like, is it possible to actually go out and do things, with this? What do I do? And I'm like, it is so possible. You can't even imagine how possible it is. Like the bar looks like the castle looks like it's closed. It looks like a castle, but if you walk around the side, it's just the facade of a castle. And once you're in it, you're like, this is like everything else. It's just been built up. So you just are coming from a background that makes this stuff look too big, and being able to share that with those students and having, done things that they looked at and went, wow, how did you do that? Then it was a pretty useful, that was sort of my approach to education, I guess, coming from the working class, going, getting some good stuff, and then maybe be able to bring it back, to them and that they would have value for. So there is a lot of that in, I think, still in education.
I think I have the same feeling, but I tell it in a slightly different story, that to me, the students over time that were in a way the most rewarding or taught me the most or, you know, were the ones least like me. And whatever intellectual, you know, ideational things I thought I was accomplishing, they were listening with an eye to what can I do with this? And doing that by themselves on their own. And so that person that came from a family that where there wasn't a lot of education, but they were willing to listen to what I had to say. And then all of a sudden I get these papers that take it someplace I would never have imagined. And I thought, wow, there's something that I'm not in control of happening here.
Right.
And that ultimately all I can do is set a smorgasbord and it's really up to them to fill the plate. And so I think that idea of teaching, so those are the people who really taught me to teach, I think, and taught me the value of it was in ways that I would never have predicted, could not control, because it came from their particular life circumstances and how they were, you know, that they were not the towering intellectuals. They were not just engaged in all the glittery ideas, but they were cutting through it with their own agendas and their own thinking, putting tab A into slot A right. And making something out of it. And I think that's the other thing that we don't appreciate enough in the way we talk about education is we talk about teaching as though it is indoctrination, as though we have a lot of control. The real thing is they need to be active learners and we need to get out of the way of that. So I think about my medicine analogy, but Lewis Thomas, the doctor, wrote a couple of good books, Lives of a Cell. And,
yeah.
He says, you know, the great revolutions in medicine were not when we started devising technological interventions and inoculations and these kinds of things that did such great healing. The great innovation in medicine was when doctors quit doing the stuff that they were doing and started letting the body heal itself. So quit bleeding, you know, quit doing all the bad medicine that they thought that was supported by sheer mysticism and myth and let the body's healing do its own. And I feel the same way about learning. It, you know, the part of the Department of Education here ought to be how to get out of the way of learning.
Yeah.
And it was those people who were there to learn that really, you know, you ask how I stayed in it for 40 years. Those are the people that kept me in it.
Yeah, fair enough. I can see that. And I got that sense a lot of times in my own experience with this, that I was grabbing machetes, you know. If somebody offered me a machete, I didn't care if it was something in cultural studies or interpersonal or rhetoric. I'm like, I can use that to get through something over here. And I've done that ever since, you know, in my career in Hollywood. Most people are intuitive creatives. You know, they're intuitive producers. They learn the job and then replicate the job well, but they're not really bringing theory and strategy and pre-made tactics to it. And I always had that as an advantage, even as a writer. Like I would go and when on a writing staff, a lot of times you can see what everybody else has written that day. And when I got my first job at the Late Late Show, my first Guild job on network TV at CBS, the first couple of weeks, I didn't get anything on the show. There were 7 other writers and these guys were good and experienced. And I'm like, what am I doing? And I went in and I audited all their files, looked at the jokes they were getting on the show and realized there were 2 or 3 things that they were doing that I wasn't doing. Like they would take references down to 3rd or 4th level reference. So instead of gorilla, they would use silverback. You know, it was a prettier word, more interesting word, and gave you a more specific image. And I'm like, okay, I need to add flourish to the language and get farther down into the references. And I start getting stuff on the show. And that's because I knew as a critic, look at the successful texts, abstract what they're doing, and then do that. And, you know, that's that kind of rhetoric training that I've always super valued. And it does, it kind of gives you a superpower in the world.
With the style.
Because you can absorb everybody else's stuff, you know, and they typically don't continue to do that. They don't keep to add their repertoire, which I think is the super value of education, that you get to value those machetes and whoever can give those to you, I'll go listen to them all day long. I don't care what format they want to talk to me in.
Well, that is a good case of what we began talking about, which was sort of the diminishment of rhetoric and as somehow secondary. Knowledge is structure, and the rest of it is style. You looked at style, and style activated people. You know, it is pleasurable to have your knowledge of what a silverback is activated rather than the grosser category. At any rate, and so you found the doing of it right in style. But in terms of your larger point, I think the best teachers I knew, and I would not count myself among them, the best teachers I knew were like that, right? Who would take any category, any verbiage, any model, anything, and be able to use it to get through their students, right?
Well, I think you did that. I think you were great with that with Burke. Man, you could take Burke and just weed whack your way through a text.
Talk about smorgasbords. Yeah, it's, you know. I think my strategy there was, to be cynical about it, was he would just take you out in the middle of the lake and drop you in the water, and then I helped you to swim back. You were ready for any coherence by after that.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that just has such great, I mean, very singular lines and phrases that just come back again and again and again. You know, the big text, there's so much in there to try to remember, but, you know, just the opening, what book it's in, where he says, you know, what would grasshoppers ask you if they could talk? Like, they would ask you, quick, tell me everything you know about birds that eat grasshoppers. Right. You know, that's super motivated use of language. You know, what is language for? It's to move forth and survive
in the
world.
That is what we're saying. Yeah, that knowledge is about what we can do with it, right?
Yeah. My favorite collision of worlds I ever had was, I taught a girl named Jenny Beaver at Peace College, and she was a journalist actor major there. And I gave her permission on the newspaper to cause some trouble by criticizing a long held practice at the college, you know, that had been there for 140 years or whatever. They forced them to go out and get two cultural experiences. And she went to a punk, you know, concert and wanted to write about that. And they wouldn't let her. They wouldn't identify it as a cultural experience.
Oh, so
she wrote a critical, you know, article about that in the paper, and it just blew up the whole university or the whole college. I had to have a public forum about
it. They had in mind that she would go to the opera or something, I guess.
Yeah. So
the high cult, low cult problem.
So she was super cool. And then I moved out to Hollywood and I started into TV. In my second year, I was at Fox, and I was on the Fox lot at Christmas, and they have this huge Christmas party. Like, all the stars come out and there's thousands of people, and it's a gala, like you would think, like almost like a F. Scott Fitzgerald Gatsby party, as close as I ever got to one. And we're walking around with the other writers, and I hear Professor French, and I look around, and it was Jenny Beaver, and she was working as catering at the Fox party. And for the next 2 months, everybody on the show called me Professor French. But she had moved out there to be an actor. So it's pretty cool. Collision of those worlds.
Right. Good story.
So let's wrap this with the idea. Like I said, I think as you look at the future of education and you start to see things like this, like a podcast format, I love to listen to interesting conversations. And most of the feedback I've gotten on this that has been positive has been that. It's like, hey, I just like to listen to you guys talk about this, and they learn nuggets. It's that kind of fragmented learning or maybe epiphany learning versus a linear absorption. And I like that format. I think that'd be an interesting way of.
They've been delivered to this as learners. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that should be the goal of education, is to deliver people up as learners. Right.
Right. And to give them an experience, like, it's partly entertainment. It's partly natural that you know how to have conversations and listen to them, and it's partly content that you don't get to hear talked about in exactly this sure. way. So it's a nice amalgamation, I think.
Once again, one shudders to think how one would systematize it into the programmatic educational institutions. And maybe that's the point, is just quit it.
If Burke had the podcast, who would you have wanted to hear Burke talk to? Like, if there were 150 hours of Kenneth Burke podcast talking about things, that'd be an amazing resource.
There are tapes. that are interesting in terms of the kinds of things that we're talking about, in terms of graduate students talking to Kenneth Burke and their expectations for, you know, that, expecting the old man to have read the last Quarterly Journal of Speech and know what so-and-so did with the concept of identification. So when he would answer them from his place as a completely organic intellectual that invented that language in a time and a place, they just kind of couldn't, you know.
Right. That's hilarious.
So it is kind of those two ships passing each other in many instances. I haven't seen
like, you know, like Einstein was a contemporary of Kenneth Burke. It'd be interesting to hear those two guys talk to each other for a couple of hours.
Wouldn't it? When I very first started teaching rhetoric as composition and speech combined, one of my assignments was, you on the old PBS, Steve Allen, you know, if you remember him, Steve Allen would have what he's called the meeting of the minds, and he would invite these characters from history. So Emily Dickinson, Genghis Khan, Socrates, and Dwight Eisenhower would all sit around, you know, people in costume would sit around and have a conversation at the table. So one of my first assignments as an inventional exercise was invite three people to dinner and invent their conversation. So you get an appreciation for the points of view. And those were probably the best things my students ever produced, actually.
Yeah, that sounds like a great setup for interesting stuff.
What three people would you know? And once again, you could start with what topic, you know, okay, given a certain topic, who would be the best people to have come talk about it? What would you want Kenneth Burke and Einstein and, Joseph Stalin to talk about? Radical change or something, I don't know. Or surrealism, or, you know, well, I think I'll invite Pablo Picasso instead, right?
Yeah, I love that stuff. I've got, there's a business online called the Unemployed Philosophers Guild. You know what this is?
No, not at all.
They make puppets. They make little stuffed characters of famous people.
Now, I have bought some of these, yeah.
Yeah, and so I probably have 30 because the kids buy them for me all the time for birthday and Christmas. Nice. And I make them do stand-up. So to me, like exploring their life experience and their biography and their perspective.
Did you do this for your children? I think.
I do it. I force everybody to listen to it.
Everybody to do it.
When I get into it. But like just the idea of Captain, you know, Ahab walking onto a stand-up stage and said, you know, anybody seen a fucking whale? Anybody? Have you seen a whale? so much.
Hey, particular whale, Ahab, yes. Well, I think somewhere in a box or a shelf somewhere we have an Edgar Allan Poe, you might, if you want it for your collection, I might be able to liberate it.
I've got Poe.
You got Poe. Okay.
My first was Einstein. Again, as a joke writer, putting jokes in those things' mouths is so much fun because he's like, hey, you know, I made him a one-liner comic, and he's like, I've always wanted a, you know, female a lady on my staff. Literally, hey, Einstein.
nice.
But yeah, when you combine that kind of intellectualism with some good entertainment and you put it in a new format, maybe there is some future for education.
Something educational in that, right?
Right.
But that would be a great way. Once again, you said we don't want to abandon, you know, knowledge of the people of the past. And I think that's right. And a topic that maybe is what has to follow on this is whither history, right? More and more I think, you know, once again, I talked about the knowledge industries and I consider rhetoric among them, but I think history is pivotal. And I think it is the thing most under mutation at the moment, our disposition toward the past seems to be the most fractured of the fractured fairy tales present.
Yeah. Again, my world's colliding together with history. Like I will get interested in something and then I'll write a stand-up show about it where I'll apply all the stand-up techniques to the information, the historical information. And the one I'm doing right now is Titanic. There's just so much about the Titanic that if you deep dive into it and start turning into stand-up, it just becomes this super fun show. Like how many Adolfs do you think were on the Titanic? Take a guess.
13, huh?
There were four Adolfs. Four full-fledged. It was 1912. The name was still in play. Four dead Adolfs. They all died, by the way.
No Adolfs made it.
No Adolfs made it. Has there been an Adolf since 1945 anywhere?
Probably not many.
Yeah.
That's funny.
All right, man. Well, this was super fun. We will circle back around and we'll attack another topic from the Rhetoric
Warrior. All right, then. Thank you.
All right. Sounds good. This has been the Rhetoric Warrior podcast, special Rhetoric Files, rhetorician interviews. Dave Payne, number 5. We'll see you again soon.